From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we learn how the Metropolitan Milwaukee Business Association is working to increase black and brown representation at big businesses. Then we learn about QAnon and what can make conspiracy theories attractive to some people.
Conspiracy theories kind of give them a plot that the world isn't messed up because of some random things, that there is a secret plot and plan, and that helps them kind of cope with their fear and anger about the state of the world.
Plus, we learn about new plans for the Milwaukee Public Museum and Betty Brin Children's Museum to co-locate under a new roof.
We're very excited about this opportunity because while we do have a unique location, we're in a space that was never designed to be a children's museum that's really smaller than we would like it to be.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The people who work at big businesses and corporate jobs in the greater Milwaukee area are overwhelmingly white. Even before protests over racial inequity and social justice began, the Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce had set out to change that. But some of MMAC's past policies have set up roadblocks and added to the disenfranchisement of low-wage black and brown workers in the area. WUWM's Latoya Dennis spoke to Tim Sheehy, president of the MMAC, about those previous policies and the efforts that are underway to increase black and brown representation in Milwaukee's workforce.
2018 is the most recent effort that we've initiated. When our board identified racial disparity as the biggest barrier for the region. And we commissioned an update on some work that we've done, and we looked at 20 peer regions. And the prosperity measures for Black and brown people in Milwaukee in the region here were at the bottom of those 20 peer regions. And we had the widest gap between white, black, and brown disparity in Metro Milwaukee. And so I think the evidence is unequivocal that there are tremendous disparities here in the region. They're holding us back, both as companies who want to compete and attract the best talent, and it impacts us as a community in terms of a place to live, work, play, and learn. And so what we did coming out of that those findings was we recruited 1,200 black and brown managers from area companies, and they responded to a survey, then a series of focus groups to identify some of the challenges and issues in corporate Milwaukee. And we used those findings in part to launch an effort we're calling the Region of Choice. And so if we're going to compete globally, if we're going to have high value jobs and a vibrant quality of life for all, we want to make sure that the region is a region of choice for all. And so the goal of this effort is to grow the percentage of black and brown management talent in our companies by 25% over the next 5 years and grow overall employment by 15%. And to date, we have about 107 companies that have signed the pledge, employing about 141,000 people in the region. So it's by no means an answer, but it's a pretty good start down the path to make some determined progress on an issue that's just been very, very challenging.
So are these new concerns for the MMAC?
Well, you know, I've gone back, not that I've been here since 1968, but I've gone back to look at our board notes in 1968, coming out of the summer of 1967, and the loss of Martin Luther King Jr. and the March for Fair Housing in Milwaukee. And I can go back at least that far in our records and identify the racial disparities, the racism as an issue that has been embedded in Milwaukee, going back at least that far. So this is an issue where we've made some progress, but clearly not enough. But it's been an issue, I think, that's been important to the business community for quite some time.
And Tim, to your knowledge, is this the first time that the MMAC has taken on the disparities between Black and Brown and white people in the greater Milwaukee area?
No, I mean, I think this issue, when you unpack it, both the racial disparity and the issue of racism, it's got a threat of housing, it's got a threat of education, it has a threat of employment, it has some systemic barriers in the community and in companies. So I think in one way or another, we've been working on parts of this for a long time, probably most deeply engaged in the areas of education and economic development. But no, it's not an issue that's new, even though this region of choice effort is a new way to focus the lens of the business community on closing this racial divide.
Do you believe that any of the previous stances that the MMAC has taken has helped to increase some of the disparities that we see here? For example, the MMAC supported right-to-work legislation and was not in favor of a paid sick leave ordinance in the city of Milwaukee.
Yeah, so I think let's take the two issues. First of all, let's take right-to-work. Wisconsin had not been a right-to-work state. It now is. And I think we've seen some significant economic growth. If I look over the past 5 years, just on the work that we've done through Milwaukee 7, we've attracted 46 corporate expansion projects to the region that have created almost 11,000 new jobs and a payroll of $670 million that go along with about another $1.9 billion in capital investment. And these are jobs that pay 20% above the average wage in the region. So I think that has helped to make Wisconsin a more attractive place to invest and create jobs and economic opportunity. I think it's led to the economic resurgence that we've seen, not detracted from it. And the issue of paid sick leave, again, I think the vast majority of our members have some form of paid sick leave. What we were opposed to at the time was an ordinance that the city of Milwaukee was proposing to create 9 days of paid sick leave in the city only. And our concern was that it would create a barrier in the city for companies that would move out. And there were some extraneous issues, I think, related to who that applied to. If a company had a truck driving through Milwaukee making deliveries, then that company was subject to the rules. So I just think it was a clumsy way to implement, I think, what today most employers recognize as a valuable part of their compensation package in terms of paid sick leave.
But not necessarily when it comes to the low-wage jobs where Black and Hispanic workers are highly concentrated, correct?
Yeah, and I think the challenge here is that for many employers, I think that have wages on the starting end of the scale, they're trying to balance their entire compensation package and still be able to provide a going concern or a going business. So again, I think those companies that have the ability to do it because it's a good way to recruit and retain employees. And those that don't have as much a robust package, don't have the margin or don't have the business capability to do it. It's not because they don't want to, it's because their business economics are challenged by providing that. And again, we don't have a lot of, we do have restaurants that are members, but again, most of our members are paying wages significantly above the minimum wage and have robust packages to compete for talent.
What's the average wage for your employers?
Yeah, I would say that the median wage or the average wage for our employers is probably significantly above what the median or average for the region is. So if it's $45,000, I would say that the median wage for our members is going to be closer to 50 or 60,000.
So what percentage of Black and Hispanic people are employed by your members?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the EEOC data, it's roughly for the African-American population, I think it's around 10%, and I think 7% for Hispanic. So not where it should be, not where it needs to be. And I think the issue for employers, it's an important issue in terms of having a diverse workforce. It's the right thing to do. It's an imperative that workplaces are more diverse and more hospitable than they are today. But I think it's also a necessity. If you look at The workforce population, working age population in Wisconsin, it grows by less than 1% between now and 2040. And if you look at where the population growth is, particularly the city of Milwaukee, 73% of the city's population under the age of 19 are people of color. So it's not only an imperative in terms of being the right thing to do, but it's also an economic imperative. If you're going to hire as an employer, if you're going to grow, your workplace, your culture has to be inclusive, or you're cutting yourself off from a significant part of our future and current workforce.
Now, you said 10% for Black and 7% for Latinx. Why so low?
Well, I think there are probably a number of reasons. I think there have certainly been historically and probably still today, some systemic barriers to hiring, companies that aren't as inclusive as they need to be. They don't have workplaces that are inclusive. So that's a barrier. And I think then the other barrier is preparedness. If you take 20 high school freshmen in the city of Milwaukee, largely Black and brown, and you follow that high school cohort through high school, and 6 years after it would graduate from high school, only two of those 20 have a two-year or four-year degree. And so we have a real disservice to our to people of color in the city in terms of too few getting through with the educational skills needed to enter the workforce and needed to continue to move up the ladder. So that's a big issue the community has to address, and the business community is part of the responsibility for doing that. So we need to put more people of color in a position where they have the education and the skill sets to take advantage of the kinds of jobs that are here in the economy today.
Overall, what percentage of the population here actually has a college degree?
The percentage of the adult population with a college degree is close to 36 or 37%.
And what about recruitment from other places?
Yeah, and I think it's an important part of this. But again, Milwaukee and Wisconsin does not have a net migration. We have more people moving out than moving in. So recruiting talent here is important. But I think the first thing we have to do is to develop, retain, and advance the talent that we have, the diverse talent that we have. And then part of the solution, of course, is recruiting people to Milwaukee. And that's why it's so important that corporations have a better track record, have a more diverse workforce than they do. And we also improve the disparity in the community, because it is very challenging to recruit and retain if you don't see your future in the community and you don't look up the ladder in a company and see people that look like you in higher positions in the company. So both of those are continuing obstacles to recruiting and retaining the diverse talent that we need.
Finally, I wonder if you believe the MMAC is doing enough when it comes to helping build up Black entrepreneurs and business owners.
No, the short answer is we're not. We need to do more, and we're engaged very closely with the Hispanic Collaborative, with the African American Leadership Alliance, with the Business Council, which is an ethnically diverse business group. We support those organizations. We've done a lot around supplier diversity, but we're not doing enough. And what tells me we're not doing enough is of the businesses, of the 25,000 businesses in the region that you can identify by race, only 3% are African American owned and only 2% are Hispanic or Latino owned. And so we are clearly not doing what we need to do to develop small growing businesses and entrepreneurs that can become larger employers in the region. And so while I think we're doing a lot, we're not doing enough, and we have a long way to go to improve the business climate for diverse business owners and entrepreneurs.
Tim Sheehy is the president of the Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce. He spoke with WUWM's Latoya Dennis. We'll take a short break, then look at a new book, American Madness, which explores the rise of conspiracy theories and the people who believe in them. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Conspiracy theorists were once relegated to the fringes of society, but now the popularity of these theories, like QAnon, is rising, and the impact could be devastating. A conspiracy theory generally refers to any theory of an event in which a clandestine but influential organization is responsible for creating disinformation or a major world event. Things like the Earth being flat, or that the moon landing was faked by the U.S. government, despite evidence to the contrary. While these theories are contradicted by most objective facts, they hold power over people who want to believe in them, people like Richard McCaslin. McCaslin, also known as the Phantom Patriot, was a conspiracy theorist whose dedication to these theories led him to stage an armed attack at the Bohemian Grove in California. McCaslin's life and the conspiracy theories that defined it are the subject of a new book by Milwaukee-based author T. Krulos. American Madness looks at the impact of conspiracy theories through the experiences of McCaslin. Krulos joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about the rise of QAnon, the allure of conspiracy theories, and what his relationship with McCaslin taught him about the people who believe.
This is a big question, but for the uninitiated, how do you describe QAnon and the conspiracy theories that go along with it?
So QAnon is something that developed in 2017, and it's a little bit different from other conspiracy belief because it's almost cult-like in the way that they operate. So the core of the belief is that there is this satanic cabal of pedophiles that include very prominent Democrats like Hillary Clinton and John Podesta, but also includes just this sort of lineup of the fake news media and crisis actors. And QAnon believes that Trump is secretly working on this plan called The Storm, where he's going to sort of sweep up this entire ring and, you know, put them all in jail. So he's seen as sort of this hero figure fighting this evil satanic cabal. And some of their ideas are just really off the wall. They started circulating a theory that Democrats had imprisoned mole children underneath Central Park in New York. Some of them believe that Tom Hanks is actually dead and has been replaced by a deepfake. So some of the ideas are just really frightening. And it's a growing sort of social movement.
I mean, the core ideas that you just said in and of themselves seem pretty outlandish. The idea that a number of politicians would be engaged in what's essentially a child sex trafficking ring. But it's interesting to dig into this in part because your book really focuses on this man, Richard McCaslin, also known as Phantom Patriot. And this is a man who is so absorbed with so many of these conspiracy theories that, you know, as you kind of go down this rabbit hole with him, you go, well, all of these ideas are so outlandish. And yet, you know, once you kind of believe that nothing can be as it seems, you know, you go down this road with him and you go, well, I guess if you twist everything, you can make it be what you want it to be. Can you give us some background on Richard McCaslin? Just to start there.
Yes. And you're absolutely right, too. Once you kind of take that first step into conspiracy world, the rest of it sort of follows pretty quickly, I think. So Richard emailed me way back in 2010. And at that time, you know, he would probably be considered to be a fringe character. And it's really shocking to see how now there is a whole group of people who think like him. But he experienced a really rough patch in his life. Both of his parents had died, and he was just having trouble finding fulfillment. So he's kind of down out all these bad things that happened to him, and he latches on to someone who's pretty well known now, Alex Jones. And he starts absorbing this conspiracy media by Alex Jones, and he sort of fixates on a place called the Bohemian Grove, which is a secret retreat out in California that includes some of the world's most powerful and wealthy men. So he starts hearing conspiracy theories about this place, and he decides that he's going to raid it because he hears that there are child sex trafficking victims in this place. And yeah, he just really absorbed all of this conspiracy media. He went to prison, and it only really got worse for him. He kept like spiraling into this conspiracy stuff. And so now, 10 years later, we're seeing that maybe he was in a way ahead of the curve, I guess you could say, because it's become so prevalent in our culture.
The book really maps out his descent into these corrosive conspiracy theories. It seems like he was always a man who was interested in fantasy to some extent, comic books, cosplay, superheroes, and those other kind of mainstream forms of fantasy. What made these kinds of conspiracy theories so attractive to someone like Richard?
Well, I think in his case in particular, as you mentioned, he really got into comic books as he was growing up. That was his escapism. And there really wasn't much else at that time, he didn't have the internet or anything like that. So I think that those comic book storylines really sort of influenced how he viewed the world. He saw the struggle of good versus evil, of a superhero taking on a Legion of Doom style cabal of villains. So comic books were very influential on him. And I think a lot of other conspiracy theorists, it might not be comic books, but conspiracy theories kind of give them a plot that, the world isn't messed up because of some random things, that there's a secret plot and plan, and that helps them, kind of cope with their fear and anger about the state of the world.
Do you think there was a specific moment for Richard, specifically Richard, because you did get so close to him, that really dragged him down the rabbit hole past that point of no return?
Yes. It's something I speculate in the book. Like, he just was really in the wrong place at the wrong time. Because during this very vulnerable period where, he had lost his parents, he had lost his job, he was having trouble with his creative outlets that he wanted to engage in, he just happens to be living in Austin, Texas. Austin is the home of Alex Jones and InfoWars. And at that time, he didn't have as big of a media presence as he does now, but he made these documentaries that screened on the local Austin cable access channel. So if Richard hadn't been in Austin, and if he hadn't been sitting on his couch this particular night and had seen this documentary about the Bohemian Grove by Alex Jones, I mean, things might have turned out a lot differently, but he really fixated on what Alex Jones was saying, and he was just in the right state of mind to kind of, explore that theory and how he was going to embark on this sort of superhero adventure to stop this, evil conspiracy. So I think a lot of things in his story were just him being in the wrong place.
Alex Jones is a character that, of course, comes up continually in this book. How does he feed the paranoia of someone like Richard?
Yes, and it's really interesting to see that not just Richard, but over the years there's been several other people who have done similar things to him, and Alex Jones' name comes up over and over again. He really presents himself as sort of a David versus Goliath, a truth teller, someone who's very bold. He engages in a lot of ambush journalism where he'll confront politicians on the street. He snuck into the Bohemian Grove and secretly recorded footage in there. So, you know, I think that's really the appeal of him, is that he's brash and bold, and a lot of stuff that he says sounds like it might be true. So people really follow him, and his words start to sink in.
An idea that's brought up in the book about a lot of these different conspiracy theories is the idea that many of them have just a kernel of truth, which allows people to latch on to that and then paint such a different world that is very divorced from facts and often logic. When it comes to Alex Jones and the kinds of ideas he's spewing, what are some of the things that we can attribute to him for people who might not be as familiar with, you know, his specific ideologies? I think most of our listeners will know who Alex Jones is, but maybe not everything he talks about.
Yeah, his ideas really run through the entire conspiracy gamut. So he was a very early 9/11 truther, as they call themselves. Shortly after the Twin Towers had been hit, he was on his radio show talking about how it was an inside government job, a false flag, as he calls them. And then over the years, he's talked about everything. Some of them are very bizarre, like he's talked about Hillary Clinton literally being a demon. One thing that he's very well known for is the Sandy Hook case. So on his show, he and many guests that he had suggested that Sandy Hook had actually not taken place, and that, you know, these dead children were fake, and that the parents that we see on TV were actually just crisis actors who were pretending to be parents. This eventually came back to bite him pretty good, because he's had lawsuit after lawsuit from the Sandy Hook parents, who have taken him to court, you know, for libel slander reasons. But, you know, more recently he's been in the news because he's led anti-mask protests down in Austin, and has talked about the pandemic being fake and stuff like that.
Well, and those kinds of conspiracy theories have gained a lot of steam, especially among those in the Republican Party, people who tend to be more conservative. And QAnon, as well as these other conspiracy theories, have become much more pervasive, to some extent, more mainstream through politicians like President Trump. What do you believe the dangers are there of these ideologies? You covered a bit of it with, you know, the different vigilantes, I guess we might call them, who have gone out and done some things. But what are some of these dangers?
Yes, it's a very dangerous time, and I think people should really be concerned about it. Number one, the pandemic. Obviously, if you have a population of people that believe it's a hoax and they don't think they need to wear masks or socially distance or anything like that, then you have people that are actively spreading this pandemic. QAnon this year has done something that I did not expect to see, which is they've gone from sort of a corner of the internet to running candidates who are QAnon believers. So, for example, in Georgia, Marjorie Greene is pretty certainly going to win a seat in the House of Representatives for her district in November. She's running against a Democrat in a very deep red area, so it looks very likely she's going to win. These candidates are funded by, QAnon has their own super PAC, which is called Disarm the Deep State. So a lot of these candidates are getting money through that. And, you know, it looks like there's a couple other candidates who could potentially win their elections too. So this is obviously very dangerous because one representative, okay, well, if you start getting more and more QAnon people in, you know, what's next? They could form their own caucus. You know, you might start seeing a flat earth party, you know, running for elections. And Trump, of course, because of his ego, likes QAnon. He thinks, you know, that they're supporters of his, and that's all they need.
Now, throughout the book, you really explore this relationship that you developed with Richard McCaslin. Of course, his life met an unfortunate end. But what did you learn about conspiracy theorists and the people who make up these groups through your relationship with Richard?
Yeah. I mean, I think people see these people on the internet and they think, oh, this is a delusional crackpot and they're stupid or stuff like that. But, you know, I met Richard 3 different times in 3 different cities. And when I met him, I was a little bit surprised because he was very polite. He didn't seem stupid. He's, you know, reads a lot about American history and understands how to function as an adult. And so I got along with him pretty well, actually. We had a couple of arguments online about stuff, but overall, I did consider him to be a friend. And in talking about this book to people, and I've talked to a lot of people about it over the years as I worked on it, I found that almost everybody I talk to says, you know what, this sounds like my ex-boyfriend, or someone I used to work with, or somebody who lives down the street. So conspiracy theorists are everyday people, too. So I think it's important to try to be respectful when you talk to these people. But it's also very challenging because there's not really a lot of evidence you can show them that will make them change their mind. Because anything you show them, they're going to dismiss as being, you know, fake news or a hoax or something like that. So it is frustrating to try to talk to them.
It's difficult in a world with objective facts to argue with someone that the grass is green when you're both looking at it.
Yeah, absolutely.
If the other person decides it's not, it's not much you can do.
Yeah, I mean, especially with the case of, like, I went to a flat earth convention, which I wrote about in a chapter in the book. And it's just like, how do you argue with someone that believes that the world is flat? You know, you can't really do it. They believe that every photo of the Earth is a fake, and that, you know, NASA has been lying to us, and it's just really hard to have a debate with someone that believes that.
T. Krulos is a Milwaukee-based writer and author of American Madness, the story of the Phantom Patriot and how conspiracy theories hijacked American consciousness. Krulos spoke with Like Effects' Joy Powers. Coming up next, we learn about plans for the Milwaukee Public Museum and Betty Brin Children's Museum to share a new and larger shared space in the future. Like Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. In 2018, the Milwaukee Public Museum announced its plans to build and move to a new facility. The current space MPM has occupied for more than 50 years can no longer meet the needs for storage and exhibits. Betty Brin Children's Museum also has a similar problem. They've been in a space right on the lakefront since 1995 that was never meant to be a museum. This month, both museums' board of directors agreed to create an alliance between the Milwaukee Public Museum and Betty Brin's to co-locate under the same new roof. To find out more about this recent agreement, I'm joined by Betty Brin Executive Director Brian King and Milwaukee Public Museum President and CEO Dr. Ellen Senske. Senske starts by explaining the groundwork.
Yeah, it's actually been in the works for quite a while, though the really intense part of negotiations took place all during COVID-19, but it's something that we've been, as this community knows, on a quest for a new building, and Betty Brin is also looking for new space or will be in the future, and so it just made sense to sit down and discuss whether this was a good thing for both institutions.
And both institutions right now have very unique locations, especially Brian, where you're at Betty Brin, right at the lakefront in a unique space as well. So when it came to deciding to co-locate with the Milwaukee Public Museum, already kind of looking into this and what their needs are, does having Betty Brin Museum in the works of this now significantly alter the needs the new space will have to meet?
Well, I don't know that it's a significant alteration. When you're already building a relatively significant structure, adding on what would be necessary for our museum is definitely added size and cost, but there are economies of scale once a project's already in motion. So, and for us, we're very excited about this opportunity because while we do have a unique location, beautiful location here on the lakefront, we're in a space that was never designed to be a children's museum. That's really smaller than we would like it to be. It has an odd layout, and to be able to design from scratch is extremely exciting for us as it is for the public museum.
And outside of just the new possibilities, how would this new location benefit both the Betty Brin and Milwaukee Public Museum, you know, more so from a logistic and a business standpoint? I imagine it's easier to run two places under one roof and consolidate some of the things that commonly ail budgets.
Yeah, I think that those are all the things that we've yet to determine. So what we've determined is that we want to be under one roof, that we think it's really the right thing to do for the community. It enhances both of us to be able to have people walk into one space that has two separate offerings. But we're still early in this process, and we've yet to determine what that means in terms of us being both in the same space.
Overall, do you think it'll just help the longevity of both institutions at a basic level?
I think so. Yeah, I think that this is very good for both institutions down the road. And, you know, we found in our conversations that we have points of intersection that make this, you know, potential synergies that make this really an attractive concept for us to be under the same roof as two separate museums. And we think that will pay dividends down the road.
What would you say to people who may commonly think at first that museums are each other's competition?
We don't view it as competition. We view it as the ability to collaborate, to bring in more people, to co-equally share the resources. And so we think that this being under one roof just gives people so many more options. Families aren't all one age. Families have kids that can range from 2 to 10. And so that allows families to come in and be able to partake in both institutions and have a great time in this one campus.
And from the beginning, when Ellen and I first met and started talking, it was clear that we both believed that what's good for cultural institutions in Milwaukee is good for cultural institutions in Milwaukee. And we see this not in terms of competition, but we come from a place where building up any one cultural institution is just good for us. It's good for us all.
So being a Milwaukee native, I've enjoyed both museums throughout my life. And Brian, I'm seeing you, you're at Betty Brin right now over Zoom. And it was before pandemic, but I took my nieces and nephews there with the whole family, and same thing with the public museum. So what are some signature spaces that people have always associated with your organizations and enjoyed that, you know, given that the details aren't ironed out yet, but that you plan to rehome successfully at the new space? Because you're kind of having to balance nostalgia with the modern tools and needs that you'll have access to in creating a space.
I guess I would say that for the Milwaukee Public Museum, there is nothing that will go over intact because the amount of space will be less space for us for the exhibits. But what we are bringing over will be reimagined to make it much more modern because we're developing an exhibit not for this generation, but for future generations. And so we have to look to what do future generations need and want. And so this will be reimagined, and I hope when you walk in, you'll say, oh, I remember that, but maybe not exactly that. You know, what I like to say about MPM is throughout our time, and this home will not be our second home, it will be our fourth home. So we have moved before and we have successfully moved before. What we have shown is that each step when we move into a new place, we've been cutting edge and look to the future, not to the past. We use the past to inform that future, but we've looked to see what is the need in the future for the museum. So I think that people will be excited and surprised by how we will be reimagining.
We're looking forward to creating a space that is modular, that can be reinvented as the world goes and you want to try out some new concepts. But that being said, a lot of what we do at its core doesn't necessarily change because we're all about inspiring children to wonder and explore their world through play and innovative hands-on learning experiences. And that we will bring to the new museum and things like our hometown, which is one of the most iconic parts of our museum, which is a miniaturized Milwaukee community in many ways, where roles get reversed, kids are in charge, they do the shopping, they fix the car, they deliver the mail. Some version of that for sure is coming with us.
And Ellen, with the museum, you know, a lot we don't see is in storage. And I know there's a need for a new space is being able to share and rotate what's in storage. How are you imagining that is helping to shape the new modern exhibits that you want to do?
So first of all, I want to say when we say storage, we need to understand that our collections, the bulk of them are not in storage. They're actually research collections that are being utilized by our own researchers and researchers across the world. That is actually about 3.2 million of the 4 million objects are research collections that we would not put on display because the value is in what they help us to understand about the world that we live in. The other collections, I should say, are also our anthropology collections, which then we add another 300,000 or so to that. They really are also research collections too and actively used. So the way we will be operating with the collections is those that can be changed out, we will be changing out. But we also, the big key thing for this new future museum is to really, what I say is turn the museum inside out, which is to make that research and those collections much more obvious to the public. So if you ask me, how are we going to do that? We don't have that exactly worked out yet, but it's really to make people much more engaged with what's going on behind the scenes than they are able to do right now.
And Brian, as you mentioned, it's the hands-on learning for younger children. What are you most excited about in being able to kind of reimagine and not be limited to the space you currently hold?
I'm most excited about having a bit more freedom to design experiences that are not as space limited, that can unleash kids a little bit. It's a little hard for us to do that right now. And we're also hoping that there'll be some verticality that we can work with a little bit more, because one of the really fun things to do in children's museums is to create an environment where kids feel the urge to take smart risks. because that's where a lot of their sense of self gets developed. And there are obviously safe risks in a children's museum, but they don't necessarily appear that way to a four-year-old or five-year-old. And having a bit more space to design that experience is really exciting for us.
So the agreement has been made. What are the next steps at, you know, and your approximate timeline? Obviously, so much is unknown right now, but what are you generally moving towards right now?
So we will be over the next 6 months really defining what does this really look like and getting into the nitty gritty of that. And we won't be heading into design in terms of a building until sometime hopefully in the next year. So we are still in those early stages of getting everything lined up, but it is moving along. But we, even in the best case scenario, we will not be opening this new building until 25, 26. And that's with everything going right, because these are complicated projects to pull together, because it's not just building a building, but it's also putting inside that building what is our mission and making sure that that's done right. So in the short term, it's getting this really solidified so we really know what it is, and then continuing to work towards that, being under that one roof.
And Brian, anything for you to add to that?
I would add that the timing of all of this does afford us some interesting opportunities. And we're in these relatively early stages in the midst of a global pandemic. It's entirely possible that it's not the last one that we'll ever experience. And we will be designing and building a museum with a lot better information and with a lot more attention to design for what a museum of the future should look like, particularly if we have to take some, you know, pandemic type things into consideration. And our timeline allows us to really to benefit from that, from the architects and the designers and the collective hive out there as it generates new ideas. So I think that's really beneficial to both of our organizations down the road. And I'm excited to be able to do that. It's not like we were fully, you know, three quarters designed and then had to say, wait a minute, let's pump the brakes and rethink things because of this thing called COVID.
Brian King is the executive director of the Betty Brin Children's Museum, and Dr. Ellen Sensky is the president and CEO of the Milwaukee Public Museum. We'll take one more break and then learn how hearing loss can lead to its own kind of isolation. That's when Like Effect returns on WUWM. More of Like Effect now. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Being in isolation can be extremely lonely. For those who are hearing impaired, that isolation is felt all the time. Simple communication or an ordinary interaction with another person can be challenging. Lake Effect contributor Jan Wilberg shares this essay about her experience in a doctor's office before the pandemic began.
My people don't talk in the waiting room. They're already tired from asking directions at the front desk and figuring out the receptionist's instructions. Once they are sitting down and waiting to be called, they want to be left alone. After all these years of becoming increasingly deaf, I know what other hearing impaired people are thinking. Don't talk to me. Don't talk to me. I'm saving my concentration and effort for the doctor. He's the one I need to hear today. You look nice, but don't talk to me. I look from one door to the other, worried that if I look down at my phone to kill time, someone will call my name and I won't hear. So I'm vigilant, waiting and vigilant. I don't want to be caught unaware, be the person whose name is called over and over, appear to be really far gone, need an escort to do this simple thing, go see a surgeon about a cochlear implant. I can do this on my own. A young couple with a baby in a stroller sits down a few seats over. The mom fills out paperwork while dad looks straight ahead. They both look at the baby, a boy maybe a year or so old, when he drops his little fire truck on the floor. His mother bends over to pick it up, and he drops his other toy, obliging her obvious interest in retrieving his belongings. They keep looking at him, saying nothing but radiating their disapproval of his dropping things, and the boy sits still, silently chastised. I wonder why they are there. I wonder if the baby is deaf. My name is called, and I see the doctor. He explains the surgery. He tells me how he'll make an incision behind my ear and create a pocket to hold the internal receiver. Then he'll bore a hole through the mastoid bone and thread a wire with electrodes on the end into the area of my cochlea. Then he will stitch everything up, and I will wait 2 weeks for the implant to be turned on. When it's turned on, it'll take weeks or months to get used to. He says to me, "Your word recognition will improve a lot." And when he says this, I get tears in my eyes. Here is the only place people know how bad it is. There are numbers on the paper, measurements. Your word recognition without looking at someone is almost non-existent. This will change that. I feel like someone is airlifting me from a sinking ship. A doctor is holding the door open for the couple with the baby and keeps holding it open for me. We all go back to the waiting room and then down the hall to where the elevators are. I look sideways at Mom, and she is crying. Dad says nothing, and the baby looks at me. I wave at him. I wonder if he knows how to wave. His parents are silent and miserable, but he isn't. He is being a baby. I head to the bathroom. When I come out of the stall, Mom is changing baby's diaper. It is silent in the bathroom, the baby placid and happy. But I know Mom is still crying. I think about talking to her, but I know she might say things that are important that I won't hear. She is a new person. New people take so much time for me to learn to hear. A second in a bathroom wouldn't be enough. So I leave the bathroom and I see Dad waiting. He's solemn, his hands on the baby's stroller like he's a taxi driver waiting for a tardy fare. Sadness covers him like a sheet. Is he sad for his boy or his wife? I don't know. I have no way of knowing. At that moment, I want to be their mother. I want to wait with him until she comes out of the bathroom. I want to hold their hands and I want to tell them, "Pull together or you will pull apart." A lesson I've learned from a long marriage that has had some hardships. The silence will kill you, I want to say to them. Don't let the silence kill you.
Jan Wilberg is a writer and community activist living in Milwaukee. Her daily blog, Red's Wraps, deals with politics, feminism, disability, and dogs. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, Newsweek, and several anthologies. You can find more of her work at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.